Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, I am your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is Lieutenant Stan Peel. Hi, Stan.
Hello, Rob. How are you?
Great to have you on the show. You've been a commenter on the website for quite a long time, and I've always enjoyed reading your comments, so it's nice to actually be able to talk to you directly here.
Yeah, absolutely. Likewise. And I've been listening. I think I started listening when you did the very first season.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Thank you for sticking with all that terrible, terrible sounding audio with that tin pot microphone that I had back then. So I really appreciate you sticking it out. I should have made you a captain just for that, just to jump ahead of the captain.
So, oh, that's okay.
Okay. Can earn it. So we're here to talk about the 13th episode of season 8, Captain's Outrageous. It originally aired on December 10th, 1979. But of course, Stan, this is your first episode. So how did you become a fan of MASH?
Yes. Okay. Well, let me set the background, if I may.
The time, 1975.
That's right. That's about right. Yeah. So I grew up in a small town in Wisconsin. I was born in 67. So the town that I grew up in was right between Milwaukee and Chicago. And my dad spent most of his time at the stock car track and the bar. And mom spent most of her time trying to work to keep us afloat because all the money was winding up at the stock car track and the bar. So so the parents were not around. And there wasn't a lot of money for luxuries like food and clothing. So that's the kind of situation I was growing up in. There was five of us kids, but we all kind of did our own thing because we fought a lot because the parents weren't around. And I did have a group of friends, but I still had a lot of alone time. So TV just became this really great escape for me. Kind of the way, like a lot of kids with a really good attention span would lose themselves in books. That's the way I felt about TV because I had no attention span. And, you know, I just became really addicted to it. And at some point, the family TV died. And there was no money to repair it or get a new one. And I desperately needed TV. So I actually started stealing TVs from the local charity drop-off box. I'm not proud of this, but
I think the statute of limitations has
I hope
expired
so.
By
I hope so. So and I kind of taught myself how to repair them, and I was successful at least enough for the time where I was able to get a TV for the living room again and get a couple of TVs for my bedroom so I could watch anytime.
Wow.
And by then I was in heaven. That was great. And that's about when I discovered MASH. And I say discovered it because, like, I remember specifically when I was like maybe 9 or 10, I saw a promo for MASH or I saw a scene from it. And I'm like, I will never like this show because it's dull. It's monochromatic. I probably didn't use the word monochromatic, but you know, it was just all green. And
it's
like,
all green.
I was a kid and I wanted color, you know? So for a while I kind of avoided it. And I think because of where I lived, between two big cities, we had, you know, two of everything. We had two ABC stations, two CBS, you know, and a bunch of independent stations. So, you know, you could see MASH four times a day in syndication.
Heaven.
And yeah. And so I couldn't avoid it. I started watching it and it was just, you know, I mean, you know, it's next level. It's funny. It's funny for a kid, but it's got so much depth to it. There was no way not to get completely addicted to it. So once I started watching it, and I think I would say that was around fifth or sixth grade. So maybe 78, which was probably season 6 or 7. That's when I really got hooked. And I just went all in. You know, I was like, I basically cosplayed Henry Blake. I found a fishing hat and I had a vest and I would go to school dressed like Henry Blake, you know, for, I don't know, for a couple of years. I made a still in the eighth grade. It didn't work, but I made one. I gave it a try. Also where I grew up, we didn't have middle school. So 8th grade was like the big graduation before high school, and we had like a big ceremony. And I wrote a MASH parody sketch for my class. My class was only about 12 people, so everybody could be in this sketch and, you know, play a character. And it was so heavily censored by the teacher because all the jokes were, you know, like the kind of jokes I learned from MASH, which was, you know, about booze and you know, your shorts and stuff like that. And so she censored all these jokes, so there was almost nothing left. So we didn't do the parody. And being such a big fan, I actually missed the finale, which is one of my big regrets in life. I knew it was coming, but I was in a play. I started drama that year. This was like my sophomore year, and I just assumed that the director, my theater teacher, would just cancel rehearsal because it's the MASH finale. And we got to that, you know, like a couple of days before that, and he's like, "No, I'm not going to cancel rehearsal. Are you kidding?" And so I had to miss it. And luckily, one of my friends had a dad who had a VCR, and so a bunch of the kids that were in this play got to see the finale a week later. And but the guy that recorded it edited the commercials as he was watching. And I don't know if you remember the old school VCRs, but even if you're on the ball, which this guy wasn't, and you hit record right at the right moment, it still takes a couple of seconds
Yeah,
for the record head
the
to make.
mechanics of it, you know, that kind of thing. It wasn't
Yeah.
instantaneous, yeah.
So like after every commercial break, we missed the first couple of lines, and which drove me insane. And I'm used to watching the show by myself and, you know, listening to every word. And this was a party where all these kids were like yapping and, you know, making comments about it. And I'm like, everybody needs to shut up. We're listening to this show. So it was crazy. And just one more thing. If I don't know if you remember, you were a fan when the finale happened, right?
Oh yeah, I watched it as it aired, sure.
Do you remember that there was the National Enquirer had a copy of the final script, and they published it like a week or two before the finale came out.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was so I used to read the Weekly World News, which was like a cheap knockoff of
Bat
the
Boy
National
found
Enquirer.
in cave, yeah.
Exactly. And so I read that regularly because it was funny and I knew they made up everything, right? And so I thought the National Enquirer made up everything too. So I read the script thinking that some writer just made all this stuff up. And so I read the entire thing with this attitude of like, oh, this is goofy. You know, Hawkeye goes to a mental hospital because of a chicken. That's ridiculous. You know, and so I had this kind of weird attitude about the whole story, and then I'm watching it unfold as I'm watching the finale, and I'm realizing this was the real script.
Son of
And
a
so anyway, so that was like a disastrous viewing of the finale, which is like the you know, just the worst end to this great fandom that I had all through, you know, late grade school and high school. But you know, I've been able to watch the finale a couple of, you know, more than a couple of times since then, and I've been able to absorb its greatness, you know.
Wow, there's so much to respond to that story. But I don't want to get bogged down in this detail, but I've never heard this, so I'm fascinated. I didn't know that the Inquirer did that. I leave the National Inquirer was not like on my radar at 12 years, no pun intended, at 12 years old. How did they publish a script for a 2-hour television show
I
in issue of the Inquirer? That paper, I'm putting air quotes here. That newspaper was
yeah.
like 30 pages at most.
Well,
How did they literally do it?
they had to cut stuff, but honestly, I couldn't figure out what they cut because
Okay.
everything that they mentioned w was in the finale. But maybe not every detail, you know, maybe
Okay, so it was like
they
bullet points of it wasn't literally the
yeah, it
script.
was
It
like
was like we read it and this is what happens kind of thing.
Yeah. So,
Okay. Wow, that seems actionable, right? I mean,
well,
not that the Inquirer worried about legal niceties, but still.
yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, the big question is who was the person on set that shared the script?
Yeah, Wow.
You know, because I don't think they ever figured out who that was.
No, okay. That's an amazing origin story. I mean, I have to say, learning to fix televisions on your own that you have absconded with just so you and your family could have a television, that is like rugged individualism. Like that is the true American spirit of just we go and we do things that need to get done. And as a young boy, you had that level of like stick-to-itiveness and mission and focus, and then you could teach yourself how to repair televisions, and then you go into drama, which is kind of like an interesting turn. So like all of that is fantastic, right? That is just like the American spirit kind of
Well,
story,
thank you.
you
And I
know? It
will
really
say
is.
it was a little bit easier back then because, like, things were, you know, there were tubes back there. And,
For
like, if the old.
you, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't. I'd electrocute myself. What are you talking about?
I did
Obviously,
electrocute myself a couple
I
of
mean, are you
times.
mechanically inclined generally?
No, I
See,
absolutely.
I don't know how you would have done that then. Okay, I take the credit. Take the credit. Take the
Okay.
win, Stan. If someone had
Okay.
handed me a television in 1978 and said, "Fix this," I'd be like, "What the? What? I don't." You know? So you figured it out. Good for you, man. That's good. Now,
Well, thank you.
were your siblings? They must have been thrilled, right? That you were bringing television back into the house thanks to
Well,
your ingenuity.
I only shared one with them. The rest were
Oh,
for me.
okay, but one. I mean, if you have
But
no
yes,
TVs and you have one, that's a 1,000% increase.
they did kind of appreciate it, but my brother, he was a real bookworm. Like, he didn't watch a lot of TV except
Okay.
Star Trek and Doctor Who.
Okay, got it.
You know, like, and he read a lot of comics. I borrowed all his comics so I could read
Okay.
them. So,
Wow. It's amazing. That's amazing. That's just an amazing story. I love it. I love everything. I love everything about it. You know,
thanks.
it's great. I just think, and what was with the acting teacher? That's
He
like,
was.
we're not watching MASH. What the hell is that about?
He was just like. He was not a TV watcher. I mean, he
Okay.
did,
Oh, okay. So he
you
was
know,
like,
he
oh,
did
it's
our,
popular, you know, lift his nose at it kind of thing.
well, and also he did a lot of theater. Like, he
Okay.
directed our stuff and he worked at a community theater. He was a great guy, but yeah, he didn't have a lot of time for TV,
Huh.
apparently.
Amazing. It's
Yeah.
all of that is just absolutely amazing. So, okay. How now did you eventually, if you can remember this? Oh, okay. That was the other thing I wanted to mention. I was forgetting already. I would kill to see the finale with commercials again. Like if someone made that available. And said, and it wouldn't have to. I'm look, I would love it from my personal market, as I've told, you know, I've talked about endlessly, Philadelphia, but I wouldn't even need that. If someone just said, hey, there's probably copies out there, maybe that I've never bothered to look, but like, I would love to, if someone said, we've issued MASH finale, but with all the local commercials as they aired in California or New York or whatever, one of the big market, I would love to watch that just to see what was el what it, like what CBS. I mean, obviously they're gonna have like the standard like Rice-A-Roni ads and you know whatever else was being, but like what TV shows did CBS think we're gonna launch these new shows by putting ads on for them during MASH, during the biggest audience we could possibly ask
Oh
for? I'd love
yeah.
to see all that stuff. That'd
It
be
would be
absolutely
so
amazing.
cool. And the thing is, I remember because those were the early days of VCRs, and I
Yep.
remember this was like an issue. Like, people wanted to save tape and they wanted to skip the commercials.
Yep.
And there was no, you know, this, I mean, this idea that I think, you know, that you and I have and other people that we know probably, you know, the idea of having these vintage commercials and as part of a show, it is an awesome thing. And I don't think there was any thoughts along those lines back then. It was just, you know, commercials are terrible and they're in their way and they waste tape. And so, you know, there were VCRs that came out that were supposed to have the technology to skip commercials, and I don't think it ever really worked.
Yeah, I don't remember those. Yeah.
It didn't last very long.
I would love to have all my old MASH tapes again. Just I still have the paper, the piece of paper that I used where I wrote a master list of every episode. And as I got them recorded off of syndication, I would cross them out. And I still have that, and it's in my complete book of MASH by Susie Coulter. I stuck it in the dust jacket, and I'm like, I'm amazed that I kept it, but I love it because it's such a great little reminder of what an insane little nerd I was. You know, that at like 12 years old, other kids are like playing sports, and I'm like, oh, this one's from season 11. I don't have Who Knew? Cross, 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 cross. You know, like what a
Awesome.
lunatic.
Oh, speaking of something you said reminded me of this that I wanted to mention. You talked about the syndication. Because I was between Chicago and Milwaukee, I saw, because you talk about how the episodes are edited for syndication, and there was a big difference between the way the Chicago station, Channel 32, edited their syndicated episode and Milwaukee, Channel 12. Channel 12 in Milwaukee left it almost entirely untouched, as far as I could tell. But you could tell that the Milwaukee or the Chicago station was heavily edited. And so I could see early on, even when I was watching way back then, that that Chicago was editing all this stuff out. And there was, so there was, I don't know who, who got to make the decisions and all that, but there was a definite difference. And the thing is, the Milwaukee station, when they played it took 34 minutes. Like I noticed their news came on after MASH, and it was like at 11:04.
Really?
Yeah, MASH started at 10:30, and probably because they didn't want to edit it, but they wanted to get all their commercials, it played for 34 minutes. It was
That's
the weirdest thing.
amazing. That, well, obviously MASH was a big money winner for them then. If they were doing that, if they were willing to go 4 minutes over time, that means they were making some serious money. I again, like, I'm just a giant nerd on this stuff. I find that fascinating. I love the idea that there were how many different markets out there that all made their own versions of the episodes. I'm like, that's crazy. Think about how hard these people were. Anybody, right, works to make a half hour, an hour of television, and actors and writers and directors and costumers and the key grips and the cinematographer and all that. And some actor might be like, "Hey, I'm finally in a MASH. I did." And yet in syndication, his scene is cut forever because some jamoke in Wisconsin is like, "Well, we don't need that scene." Like, what? I don't know. It's amazing. No, so okay. Do you remember at what point because if you're watching them in syndication, was there a way you knew, like, oh wait, I've seen them all? Or did that take until like you got the DVDs or saw them on Hulu where you were like, okay. Because of course, if you're watching them on syndication, you don't exactly, unless you have a master list for yourself, unless you have like a book, you don't really know, right? How many are out there for me to see?
I had no idea until I got the DVDs. And
Gotcha.
even the
Okay.
DVDs, I got little by little. Like, Best Buy started selling them, I think, in 2008 or somewhere around there. Maybe a little later. It doesn't matter. But but they would only have like one or two seasons at a time, and they weren't in sequence. So I'd show up there and I'd be like, "Well, there's MASH season two and season six." And for a while, I wasn't going to buy them. I wanted to get them in order, and then I thought, I think I better buy these because, like, what if next week I can't get season two? So it took me like a couple of years, but eventually I got them all.
That's fascinating. It really
But
is.
yeah, I remember I was watching. I had watched what I thought was the whole way through, but apparently I had never seen Welcome to Korea,
Oh, wow.
until like, I don't know, two years after I started watching, because the episode started and I thought, what is this? This looks awesome. I because the opening has got this great big wide shot, and I'm like, what's going on? So anyway, yeah, it was basically in order. I don't think Chicago was as good at keeping them in order as Milwaukee was, I missed a ton of them, I'm sure, here and there, because once I started doing theater, it was tough to keep up.
Yeah, wow. There was one episode I remember because I made the list from, again, Susie Coulter's book. I was able to, and there was, I wish I could remember what episode it was. Maybe I'll look in the notes and see if I can determine it, but probably not. But there was one episode that I never could get to record. Like, they just never ran it. And like, you know what I mean? Because I tried to watch MASH. They aired MASH, like you. They aired it four times in Philadelphia. They aired it from 7 to 8 and then from like 11 to 12. Mm-hmm. So I was recording them all, and I was and every time I'd get one, I'd cross it off. And I think at the end, like, I could remember what episode it was, but it was just some random episode. It wasn't like Welcome to Korea or some big one. It was like, you know, the Winchester tapes. I'm like, why can't I find the Winchester tapes? It drove me insane. It was just like, why is Channel 29 mocking me like this? So that's amazing stuff, Stan. That's absolutely amazing. Good for you. And you went and you're like, I need my MASH and I will create a situation where I can get MASH again. Good stuff. So, all right. So we're here, as I mentioned, we're here to talk about Captain's Outrageous. It originally aired on, as I said, December 10th, 1979. Remember that date, everybody. Written by Tad Mumford and Dan Wilcox and directed by Burt Metcalf. Mm-hmm. There's another round of promotions coming, and Father Mulcahy has his hopes up. He will finally get promoted to captain. Colonel Potter writes Mulcahy a glowing letter, bursting at the seams with praise to I-Corps. Meanwhile, during a drinking session in Rosie's bar, a fight breaks out, accidentally, sort of, started by Winchester, of all people. The fight gets so out of control that even Rosie is injured, having to rest up in post-op with cracked ribs. With Rosie out of commission, it leaves her bar vulnerable to the thievery of her shifty waitresses, who Rosie claims will rob her blind if given the opportunity. Margaret offers they should all run the bar while Rosie recuperates, and after some hesitancy, Hawkeye, BJ, and Winchester agree to help out. They have Rosie teach them the tricks of the trade, like shaking down the waitresses and watering down the drinks. Meanwhile, the new captain's list comes out, and once again, Mulcahy isn't on it. The normally meek Father Mulcahy is enraged. He's furious at the dunderheads in the Pentagon who passed him over once again. He storms out of his tent, leaving Colonel Potter alone. Instead of calming down, Mulcahy's anger grows, and when he's asked to break up a fight between two patients in post-op, the ones who started the fight in Rosie's, he does so by threatening to beat them both to a pulp. It works. Back in Rosie's bar, Winchester gets in an argument with a drunken, I have here in my notes, Sergeant Rizzo, but we'll talk about that, which leads this guy wanting to deck Winchester. Rizzo, quotes, is arrested by an Australian MP named Muldoon, who walks in expecting his usual free drink, an arrangement with Rosie that Winchester knows nothing about. This causes another row, and Muldoon storms out. A few days later, everyone meets at Rosie's, celebrating her return to the bar. But there's another reason to celebrate. Colonel Potter is here to announce that, thanks to some calls he placed to the actual Pentagon, Father Mulcahy has indeed been promoted to captain. Later, Muldoon returns to shut down Rosie's bar for various penny-ante reasons, blaming Winchester, whom he snidely calls Chauncey Uppercrust. Mulcahy, full of brio, thanks to his new captain's bars, steps in to try and settle the dispute. All right, Stan, if I recall, maybe I'm wrong, this one was on your list of ones to talk about. If I'm right about that, hopefully I am. was it or was it not?
To be honest, it was not.
Okay.
But that is okay, because I have a new appreciation for this episode, having watched it and taken notes. Like, it was not in my, you know, my top five or whatever for the season, but the more I watched it, the more I loved it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm totally glad I had this episode.
Okay, good. Cause I like this one. I like this one a lot. I think it's a lot of fun. I will talk about some of the interesting characters that show up in this one, both kind of on screen and off, but again, we'll get to that as we get to the end. And I like Father Mulcahy, and I want to see him get promoted. You know what I mean? It's like, he deserves it. So it's finally, MASH was so often willing to kind of dump on the characters and kind of be like, everything sucks at times, but it's nice for them to have a win once in a while. So,
right. Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah. And the thing is, you know, having a showcase for Rosie, for Eileen Saki, is fantastic. And bringing John Orchard back, also fantastic. And if I may, I have this theory about, well, it's not a theory, I don't know. It's a position I take about MASH. One of the many things, and there are many, one of the many things that make MASH work so well is the fact that it's kind of a fish out of water story overall. Like when you think about it, nobody's supposed to be there except maybe Margaret. Everybody has another place they'd rather be. Even Potter, I think, because he everyone talks about, back home and their loved ones. There's someplace else that they should be, and yet they're stuck in this place. And so to me, that's that fish out of water element makes it work and makes it kind of wonderful. And this episode is like a double fish out of water because there's that element and then there's the surgeons trying to be bartenders and Rosie taken out of her element where she's she's this mover and shaker and she's stuck in a bed. And so that's what I grew to love about this episode.
I agree. I can only imagine if you're Eileen Sackey, like she did when she got the Night at Rosie's script and then this script, kind of back to back season, she must have been like, this is awesome, right? I'm getting a lot to do all of a sudden. I have a lot to do. But yeah, that's true. Yeah, they are. This is, and of course, Mulcahy, the whole bit of that, you're not going to get promoted without probably putting a little bit of effort into it. And of course, that's something Mulcahy is not one up for because he's supposed to be meek and humble, and he's in a war zone where meek and humble doesn't exactly fly. So yeah, and right. So they both have that kind of, theme running around in them. So the episode opens with Klinger reading the letter that Potter wrote to get Mulcahy promoted, and there's this bit where everything is he says outstanding like 17 times, which is like that's how like when I write my articles for when I do my Real Retro Cinema column for 13dimension.com, which is about movies and comic books, that those are always my first drafts where like I go through them all and I'm like I use the same word 17 times, what the hell am I doing, and I go through and I pull them out. But I kind of read that. I love that. I like that Potter is not a great writer, which I like, right? Because why should he be? Why? Well, he's got a lot of skills. But he's not a particularly great writer. He writes like he talks. You can hear him imagining saying it. So I thought that was, a funny little bit. And then of course Klinger's trying to get Mulcahy all excited. Potter hears that, comes storming out, and he's like, "You've got about a mouth about as big as the Missouri Gap. That report was supposed to be confidential." And then Klinger's response is, "Sir, you were eavesdropping on my private conversation." I love that he's not cowed by that at all. By Potter yelling at him, it's like, "Sir, you're invading my private conversation." So I love that. And then Potter calls him the Lebanese Walter Winchell, which I appreciate. Again, that's one of those references that as a kid I was probably like, "I don't know who that is, right? I don't know who Walter was, but I guess he's somebody that talks a lot." Is there? Like, that's the context of the joke, whatever. Okay. So now this whole opening scene is sort of like, hey, you know what? You want to imagine a show with just these three characters? You might get that after MASH goes off the air. It's
That's
these three
right.
guys
That's
here.
right.
And so I like that in the scene here where Potter is saying, I'm going to cash in all my IOUs. You're going to get this. And Mulcahy is like, all right, maybe. And then Potter's like, I feel like I just told him his dog died. And then Mulcahy walks out of the office. And then you hear him yell and he's excited. I have to say, that's kind of how I go through life is with the Mulcahy thing, where I'm always kind of like, all right, yeah, I guess maybe it'll work. It'll be okay. I don't know. Are you like that?
I try to be stoic with my reactions. I got a dream job, maybe, I don't know, 13, no, 15, 16 years ago. I got this job that I was really after. And when I got it, my wife was like, you gotta cheer, you gotta yell, you gotta, give it a woohoo. And I'm like, woohoo. Like I was trying to muster this like really demonstrative reaction and I just couldn't do it.
Interesting. I tend, for whatever reason, I tend to like not want to get too excited about something until it happens. And my wife is always sort of chiding me because she's like, you got to think positive. You got to act as though it's going to happen. And I'm like, yeah, okay. And I don't know why I do that. I don't know where I learned that bad trait because it's not. I don't know. I guess it's like I'm trying to like protect myself from being too disappointed, but I also know in my brain how disappointed I'll be. So who am I fooling? It's a strange mentality that I insist upon. I don't know.
I understand it.
Yeah, it's very weird. Well, by the way, if you mind it, what was the dream job? I'm fascinated with that
Oh,
one.
it
What
was
was?
I landed a producer job at a TV station
Oh, very
where
good.
I'd be producing local commercials and video editing and writing commercials and stuff like that. It was really great, and it was different than anything I'd ever done. And I loved that job for probably 10 or 11 years, and then I started to not love it so much.
Okay.
So
All right. Well, 10 or 11 years is a, that's a
it
good
was a good
run. That's a good
run.
run. It's a good run. Very good. All right. Well, that's great. So, after that, we cut to Rosie's bar and our three doctors are drinking. And then we see a couple of various soldiers, Greek soldiers and Turk soldiers, and they are all a little too loose with the liquor. And of course, Winchester tries to get a drink from Rosie and he ends up crossing between the two of them. And they're already calling each other Greek pig and all this kind of stuff. So it's all right. Things are a little bit edgy. We follow Winchester and he's talking to Rosie and she expects him to give her a tip. And she's like, "You call this a tip?" He goes, "No, I call this my change." In the background is Nurse Kelly smoking a cigarette. What is that about? No,
I
what are
did
you
not
doing, nurse?
notice.
Yeah, she's smoking a cigarette. She's a nurse. She knows better. I know some doctors smoke. Some nurses, they're people first. But what is she doing? Why are you doing? That's not right.
Well, it's a war zone,
I guess so. I mean, but it just seems, okay. So Winchester gets a drink and he gets the drinks and he's bringing them back. By the way, he's carrying three drinks simultaneously. Hard to do. And meanwhile, the Greeks and the Turks are continuing to argue, and it breaks into one of them grabs one of Winchester's drinks and throws it on the other guy, and it starts a fight. The main Greek soldier, is played by an actor named Paul Kavonis. He was on TV shows like T.J. Hooker, Fall Guy, Matt Houston, and MASH. This guy was in the other episode of MASH from last season, where Winchester and Klinger come across the truck full of wounded soldiers who don't speak English,
Oh,
and they have to
right.
cut into the
Okay.
guy's chest. That's Paul Kavonis. That is Paul Kavonis.
That's the same guy.
That's the same
Okay.
guy. Now, the other guy, the Turkish soldier, is Suri Murad. He was on the season three episode of MASH, A Full Rich Day.
Oh,
The
yeah.
Turkish
Hard to forget.
soldier that gets into the fight with Hawkeye, damn good Joe, carbohydrate. He's that guy. So whenever they needed an angry Turk, they just called this guy. He had a specialty. So
Absolutely.
he had a specialty. So anyway, these guys start this fight. Rosie tries to break it up. Poor Winchester kind of can't get out of the middle of it, and the whole thing descends into a giant fight. And it's comical. At one point, one guy has like a guy's leg over another guy's neck. Like it's very, very mad world almost kind of fight a little bit. And
I did notice that Rosie just kind of backs up out of the fight, out of the melee. So I don't know how she gets injured, because like she's safe. Like she just slowly backs up and she's behind the bar. And Charles is the one that gets the brunt of he goes down hard at the very end of it. So I'm surprised that he's not injured.
I'm going to have to assume that the fight got even more out of hand, right?
Yes,
And we're just
there
not
was more
seeing
fight that we
that.
didn't see.
There was more fight that we didn't see, and Rosie got injured. And that's because, I mean, I mean, she's tiny. I guess it doesn't take that much for a cracked rib. But yeah, a cracked rib is, sort of serious, for Pete's sake. So then we cut to everyone, all the doctors examining them all in OR, and we see that everybody's got various levels of injury. The Turk soldier asks BJ, "What are you about to give him?" He's got like a hypodermic, and he says, "Something to kill the pain while I fix your leg." And he says, "I am Turk. I not need that." And then, of course, the guy that Winchester's working on says, "Turk no need. I no need." And so this guy's like, "Okay, great." So
Oh,
they Yeah, go
Can I
for it.
just
Go ahead.
mention
Yeah.
the way the scene starts? It's one of my favorite MASH things. I don't know if it's a Burt Metcalf thing or if it's just something that shows up every now and then, but it's like a sort of a follow reveal where, the whole first portion of the scene is just one shot where they start on the X-ray, and then they go to the first table, which is Potter and Rosie and Margaret. And then Margaret goes to the next table, and that's where BJ and a soldier are. And then Kelly crosses in front of them, and the camera follows her to the next table, which is Hawkeye and I think the Greek. And then, oh no, maybe it's the Turk. It's the Turk. And then Kelly crosses behind them, and the camera follows her to the last table, which is Charles and the Greek.
That's the
And
Greek. Yeah,
so
the, yeah,
and
yeah.
and so that's a whole uncut sequence, which is, I think, just lovely.
Yes, that's right. It does. Right. We follow Margaret across. Yeah. I mean, again, it's MASH, I'm doing TV. You don't really have a chance to probably do a lot of kind of showy scenes or even anything that's a little bit different. So you're probably looking wherever you can to just add some visual interest to it. But yes, you're right. I should have mentioned that because you do notice it that it's, oh, okay, yeah, this is a one the camera goes from this to this, say their lines, to this, like it's, and you said you've got Kelly going in the background and stuff like that. So yeah, it's a nice little moment from Burt Metcalf. So, Rosie talks about that, if she's out of commission, Rosie's bar is out of commission. And of course that upsets everybody. And then Margaret is the one who has the idea to say, you guys should, since you sort of helped start the fight, you guys should step in and help run the bar because that's Rosie's livelihood. And I like as a ongoing character beat, Margaret is always standing up for other women. That's always something she's going to do, whether it's the mother who thinks Klinger propositioned her daughter in private finance this season. It's always, Margaret is always fighting for women to be heard, which is a nice little detail for Margaret to be going across the seasons.
Absolutely. She's a great advocate.
Yeah, I just like that as a detail. So of course Winchester doesn't want to do it, but Margaret is basically saying, sort of saying, no, you're not getting out of it. And I love that Margaret has no authority really over any of these guys to do it. She just does it by the sheer force of her personality, right? She just badgers them into her. You're just kind of like, okay, all right, okay. So. Now, then we got to post-op, and they're talking to Rosie, and she's explaining the whole thing about how we shake down the waitresses and how she bribes the military police. And she says he's also like my sort of like advertising. And of Mar I like Margaret is just offended that somebody in the military would take a bribe, which is like Margaret. Okay. Hawkeye refers to this guy as the man in the gray flannel fatigues. Now, that is a reference to the book and movie, The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, which did not come out until after the Korean War. So, Hawkeye had a really good source to that original novel that he was able to read it in like in galley form or something before it was actually published.
I have to tell you about this scene. There's something about the way we get to learn about how Rosie works that is just thrilling to me as a viewer. It reminds me of there was a scene in another episode. I think it's the one where Charles is up all night doing his taxes, and
Oh,
Igor
yeah.
comes in,
Yeah.
and Igor explains his day, like or his morning, the morning that he has to go through to Charles, and Charles is not listening, but
Right.
I am. Like, I think it's fascinating to learn about how Igor starts his day.
Igor gets up at like 4 in the morning to start the day. Yeah.
And I guess it feels like a peek behind the curtain, like you're these secondary, I don't know if secondary is the right word, but these supporting characters, or the characters you don't see all the time, they kind of come in and do their utilitarian thing, and you don't really learn about them. But in these moments, when you get to learn about them, it's like you're seeing a dimension of the show that is extra. And so hearing about how Rosie runs her business and the fact that, you know, in at each turn, it sounds like she's being, you know, mean or manipulative, but then she explains why she does it. Mm-hmm. You know, she's like, why do I take 30% from their tips? That doesn't seem fair. Well, it's because they're stealing from me. So right. I have to get some of it back. You know, so I just love that about this scene.
They all have their own lives, right? I mean, we only see them every so often, but they've all got their own. I mean, running a bar in Weijangbu, Korea during a war, got to be pretty difficult, right? It's got to be a pretty tough gig. So you got to be, you got to do whatever you got to do. So yeah, I do like all that we find out all this stuff about how she, you know, how she manages to get things by. Now, I don't fully understand. All right, I don't understand the legal niceties of this, but like the army doesn't own the land that they're like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how the army has the authority to tell Rosie anything about her bar. It's like, it's not on the campground. If it was on the campgrounds, they could say, you can't, you know, but it's not. So like, I don't even understand how any of that works, but okay, whatever.
I guess the way I take it, and I have, you know, what do I know? But I take it that like, he can't shut her down, but he can tell army personnel not to go in there. Like
They can make
control
it
over them, but not
there you
over
go.
Her.
Yeah. They can make it off limits and that would hurt her business. So maybe that's what it is. But it is a little like, you know, why do they have to listen to her at all? So, and Eileen Saki is great as Rosie, cause she's just very forceful and very funny. And she gets some really, truly great lines in this episode. And again, the idea of I have to steal from the waitresses cause they're already stealing from me, which, okay. All right, great. So we then cut to Potter on the phone with a friend named Herb, who is trying to get Mulcahy's letter up to the right channel so he gets promoted. And he's getting very frustrated. He hangs up with the guy, but he rubs his temples and he says, referring to Herb, man graduated 312th out of 320, and he says he's going to do his best. I like how Potter remembered that. Right?
Yeah.
Like,
it's the defining characteristic of his old friend.
I guess so. I think that's great. So then we're back in Rosie's bar and we're making like an episode of Cheers where everyone is behind the bar and working. There's a really charming scene with Hawkeye and Kelly. This is a good episode for Nurse Kelly.
Yeah.
Kelly Nakahara, where they flirt back and forth. And it's really cute.
Yeah,
I really like it. I like that she, you know, he's like, oh, you think just because I have a body that won't quit, I'm a cheap one night stand. And then he's like, okay, but just this one night. And she pinches his cheek. It's really charming. Really cute.
It was such a sweet moment. I had to look up when Hey, Look Me Over happened.
Yeah, it's after this.
I couldn't. Yeah, it's way after. It's like the last season, I think.
Yep.
Yeah. So still wonderful.
Yeah, it's really I find that just to be very, very charming. And so then Margaret goes up to Hawkeye and says, we have a problem. One of the waitresses owes us money. She owes us $1.26. And
oh, my God.
So Hawkeye goes over to talk to this waitress, and the waitress, the actress is Momo Yashima. This is her third MASH. She was in the ping pong episode. She was the bride of Cho, the ping pong player, in that episode. And here she's playing Suni. This is her last appearance on the show. And she doesn't speak English. And Hawkeye is desperately trying to get her to figure it out. And like most people do when someone doesn't understand the language, you just talk louder. expecting that to work. And he's getting frustrated. And I love her grin. She just is kind of like, you know,
yep.
And he's like, Rosie, you know, and he's like, keep saying it over and over. It's just not happening. So I love all that. That's great stuff. And then he gives up and, decides to just pay the money, for her and doesn't tell Margaret. And he just foots the bill, which I've done that in a couple of times in my life where it's just been easier. You know, then an argument, I'll just pay for it myself. It's fine.
Right.
So I think all that stuff. He's like, nice babbling with you. Like and I like how serious Margaret is taking all this, right? Like she's really, she's got the coin box out and all the money. Like she's really, really taking this seriously. I love all that stuff. So then
Yeah,
we.
I love that she jumps in because at first when she says, well, you guys ought to do this, it's your fault and you ought to do this. I'm like, I thought to myself, well, Margaret, you should help. Don't just tell them to do it. And of course she's there in the trenches.
She's doing all the money side and probably ordering the drinks and things like that. So then we're back in post-op and Margaret is talking to Rosie, and Rosie is not the easiest person to get along with, right? Because she's kind of very hypercritical, and Margaret even says, "Rosie, we're doing our best." And then she gets served some food and she hates the food. She says, "That's terrible." And Potter is even getting frustrated of kind of like, okay, and I don't know. I've experienced that in life sometimes. We've done a favor for somebody and you didn't exactly do it the way they wanted, and they were like hypercritical, and then you're kind of like, huh. Well, okay then.
She, I mean, but she can't help but be Rosie. And I do love how she, even though she's frustrated and I can tell that she cannot stand being confined to that bed. She's still, Eileen Sackey never goes over the top. She never gets like loudly angry or, she, it at, it sort of goes back and forth between a little bit of, a little bit of anger and then a quiet sort of insult. Like she holds it in, and it's just so beautifully done. I need to see her in more stuff.
And I like the follow-up where the Greek and the Turk get into a fight, and Margaret tells Joanne the nurse, go get some Corman, and in the background, out of focus, they're fighting and beating the crap out of each other, and she's like, if you guys run my bar the way you're running this hospital, I'm out of business. So she's just thoroughly unimpressed with how MASH 477 operates, which is great. And good job by, again, Eileen Sackey. So then we're in Mulcahy's tent, and he's very, very excited. And he sees Potter coming in, and he thinks he's going to get good news. And then Potter has to lower the boom where he says, "The promotions list came out, and you weren't on it." Now, again, I never really understand how the paperwork works at MASH. Like, did they deliver it? Like what? I mean, did they wire it? Like what was it like? Do they make a special trip? I mean, I'm sure it's with other paperwork, but it's just sort of funny that I'm like, how often are they getting forms delivered? I don't know. Maybe all the time. Maybe every day. Maybe somebody's coming to iCor every day. But there was just something funny about that. It came out like it was an email or something. It's like, okay. I saw the PDF, Padre, and you weren't on it. It's like, what?
Yeah,
What's that?
it kind of makes you wonder how much time has passed because like for the people in post-op, it doesn't seem like that much time has passed. But maybe that's my mistake, because Hawkeye does say at some point, I've already fixed his leg once from you attacking him. And so more time is probably passing than I think.
I guess so. Yeah. They jump around. They absolutely jump around a bit where, and like, you'll find out sometimes with like a line that you're like, wow, a month just went by between the last scene and this scene. You know what I mean? And it's kind of just
Yeah,
how they
but
do it.
everything
So,
looks the same because it's all
yeah,
green.
exactly. So, oh, by the way, the TVs that you fixed, were they color TVs or were they some black and white TVs?
There
Because, I
was
mean,
one the there was one big beautiful color TV, and I swear to you, I rolled this thing, little sixth grade me, took this giant color TV, and back then they were heavy. And the only way I could get it to my house was to roll it end over end all the way to my house, which was like, it was actually 2 blocks, but I had to go around like the long way, like 4 blocks out of my way, so people wouldn't see me rolling this TV across town into my house. And this is, of course, like my mistake, because I'm sure everybody in this small town saw little Stan Peele rolling a giant color TV through, down the sidewalk. But yeah, that was a find, that big color TV. And I did have to fix it because when I rolled it, I loosened a wire from a tube, but I
Oh
found it.
no.
Yeah, but I found it and it worked, so I was psyched.
Yeah, I mean, it makes
So
me sad.
it was like a 25-inch color TV.
That's a big TV. Yeah, I mean, it for some of the younger people listening from to the show, making this sounds like I lived in the 50s. But like my first TV for my room was black and white. Like, it was a black
Oh
and white.
yeah.
It wasn't like we didn't have color ones. It was just black and whites were cheaper, and so
Yeah,
that's what I
yeah.
got. So yeah,
Yeah,
I
and all the
lived in.
rest of the ones that I got were black and white.
There you go. Yeah, it's like a
But that one
Paleozoic
color
era.
TV, it was good.
So, anyway, Potter is feels really bad, and okay, he goes on a kind of a tear, and he talks about some of the stupid people that he knew back in like seminary school and their majors, and he says, I got a feeling somebody up there doesn't like me, which is very, which I don't know if that's like a direct lift to the movie Somebody Up There Likes Me, the boxing movie with Paul Newman, or it's just that was a phrase in the culture, but nevertheless. So, and then he storms out. And he left Potter in his own tent to just sit there and feel bad about what's happened, because again, he feels like he didn't come through for the Padre, as he likes to say. And that's our act break. That's the act break of our episode. So then we come back, and okay, he is doing the punching bag. He's got his not the punching bag. What's that? What is that called? The little bot bag that they have. Oh God, somebody in boxing. Yeah.
I can't
Anyway,
remember. But I got to tell you, I love boxing Mulcahy. I love when they show off his boxing skills, because there's something about this sweet, loving man who knows how to throw a punch. Like, that dichotomy of him being absolutely able to beat the crap out of somebody, which he would never do except that one time,
Yeah, and
you
Dear
know.
Sis, he throws a real haymaker in that one, yeah.
He really got him. But like, other than that, he it's just a way for him to blow off steam and to maintain the skill. And the thing in season 10 in Heroes where he talks to the champ about keeping one foot in the ideal plane and the
Oh,
other
it's a
in
great
the
speech.
real world, that's so beautiful. And that speech, it tells you so much about Mulcahy, and so I love any time they show him boxing.
Yeah, it's a nice it's a nice, that that's I can't wait to get to that episode. That's a really great one. Way off in season 10, for God's sakes. So Klinger comes in and begs Mulcahy to come help, because he's like, there's a fight going on, and Mulcahy's kind of feeling sorry for himself, and he's like, fine, it's one of my thankless jobs. Klinger, and then we see the fight almost gets broken up by Hawkeye, and then it starts all over again, and he's in the middle of it. And then Klinger runs in with a great line. He goes, now it's worse. Hawkeye's beating up two cripples.
Can I do a very short sidebar
Sure.
here? Because I, as a kid, like you say, some of these references go over your head. And for me, in like a small town, I did not understand the Turks against Greek thing at all. And I guess I let it go and never really kind of looked it up. So I did look it up for this, and I just wanted to mention that I won't read this whole thing, all these notes that I took, but the main thing is the Ottoman Empire, which was centered around what we know as Turkey. That's when they, he says, you enslaved my people. And the Ottoman Empire encompassed Greece. And the Ottoman Empire went from it was like the 1300s all the way up through like 1919. Like, it was hundreds of years.
Wow.
And Greece didn't win their independence until they won it a little bit earlier, before the Ottoman Empire dissolved. They got independence in 1830, but still, that was like, shortly before our Civil War. That was like during our Western expansion. So it was hundreds of years that they were basically enslaved by the Turks. And so I guess, and even after World War I, there were still like mutual atrocities and stuff like that. They were constantly fighting, and it wasn't until the Korean War, well, actually World War II, they started working together. And in the Korean War, that's when both countries served together, and Turkey was able to join NATO after the Korean War. So like what we're seeing is the height of their cooperation and friendliness. Because it actually kind of went downhill after the Korean War. But so like this is as good as it gets for their relations, and it's still not very good.
That's great to know. All I was taught the we learned about the Ottoman Empire in junior high or high school, and I don't remember a single thing from it other than in like a Jeopardy question. If it's blank, something empire, I'm like Ottoman. That's always the one Ottoman that I know, like empire, the Ottoman Empire. So, okay, well, that's great to know. I didn't know any of that stuff. So I just thought they were just kind of playing on stereotypes that it's like, oh, the Greeks and the Turks, they're kind of hot-blooded guys and they get in fights. Okay, that's fine, but okay, there was an actual, not historical basis to this cartoonishness, but something there. So I mean, and that you said that line about you stick my people. So okay, it's a little something.
Well, and
So
the whole thing, like Klinger says, we Mediterraneans respect holy men or something like
oh,
that.
that's right. That's right.
That's
Yes.
like one of the lines, like that's one of the ways that MASH just like, I don't know, there's so much dimension to that line. It says so much about culture and history and all this stuff all in one little line. And it's typical of MASH to throw something in that's just like a kind of a humorous line, but it says so much, you know?
Yeah, it's great, right? It's just a little throwaway thing. You may have not noticed that the first 500 times I've seen the episode. So Mulcahy comes in and he is having none of it. He basically is like, cut it out or I'll knock your lights out. That's it. And I love his little gloves. I love that he's still wearing his little gloves. I think that's great. And I like that he kind of does like the put up your dukes kind of thing. Like he rears his fist. Like he's it's good. And that ends the fight. That gets them to stop. So then we're back in Potter's office, and Potter is frustrated that Mulcahy is not getting his promotion. And then Klinger says, "You've done everything, but call the Pentagon yourself." And then Potter's like, "Hey, that's a great idea. Get on the phone, call the Pentagon." And he says, "Pentagon, that weird-looking building, four walls and a spare," which is a great Potterism. And Klinger's like, "Who do we want to speak to?" And he's like, "To whomever's home." That's great. That's a great bit. So then we're back in Rosie's, and we meet sort of G.W. Bailey as Sergeant Rizzo, but he's not Sergeant Rizzo. Now, we have already met Rizzo in the Yalu Brick Road. We've already met him here. This is clearly his first episode on the show, but they ran them out. They shot them out of order. They not shoot them out of order. They ran them in a different order than they were intending because he's clearly not playing Rizzo here. Because first of all, he doesn't have the accent. He's the, here. He's more like a Brooklyn kind of guy than what he is in Yellow Brick Road. And he's clearly not Rizzo because they don't name him Rizzo. And he gets into a fight with Winchester and he's about to strangle him, which would not work if he was a member of the 477. So I can imagine if you're watching these, you're like, wait, what? Like, what? What is this?
I actually looked, I went back and watched Yellow Brick Road because I was curious, and it is possible. I mean, you could just, for your own satisfaction, you could say to yourself, Rizzo may be new and may have not run into Charles because they don't actually speak to each other in that episode. They're in the same room, but when they're in the same room, Rizzo is off his nut with Salmonella. Like he's not aware of his surroundings. So it is possible that he doesn't know Winchester yet. But I think you're right. Like they, and you know what's interesting? They, you've probably talked about this before, but he was basically hired to replace Johnny Hamer. And they tried to get him to do a Brooklyn accent at first, and he was not comfortable with it. So he wound up making Rizzo like a Cajun guy. And so, and you said, like in this episode, it's kind of sounds like he's doing a Brooklyn thing. right?
A little bit, not
Yeah.
really, but he's definitely
So
not
maybe it
doing
was,
his Louisiana thing. He's definitely doing a
yeah.
different kind of thing.
So maybe this was a little test, you know, to try it out.
They're sort of road testing him on this performance now. And also, he talks about that he got a Dear John letter from his girl, and that they established later on that Rizzo is long married
Oh, yeah.
to a, now, of course, MASH was incredibly inconsistent about the characters' backstories. Hawkeye's mom, Hawkeye's sister, Hawkeye,
Right,
all
right.
that stuff. So I'm not going to worry about Rizzo, but this is just a weird continuity blip that it's like, okay, this is just an actor playing a different character.
Yeah.
That's just what it is. And I like that Winchester says, "Have you ever read Freud?" Which is like, Charles, what? Come on, what do you think? And G.W. Bailey is still working to this day. Like, he's still in
Yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
Good for him. And he does do. My wife and I go to these like movie TV conventions. And like, he's never been to one where we are, but he does do them. I've seen him advertised as like, oh, and I'm like, I totally would love to meet him. If he was at
Yeah.
one of these, I'd be so excited. But maybe
Absolutely.
someday. But anyway, they get into this fight, and the whole bit is that it's a college thing, because he calls him college boy, and of course Winchester immediately backs off from the fight, and then he can't help but instigate it even further.
Yeah.
And because he gets offended with like that, and then walks in Muldoon, the
Yes.
Australian, played by John Orchard. And of course, if you were familiar with MASH in its early days, you recognize this actor because John Orchard played Ugly John, the anesthetist, in the first season, who they eventually got rid of. He was a character from the movie that they transported over to the show, and then they thinned him out. And I have a couple of thoughts on
Yeah.
this. One is, like, how does he end up back in the rotation, right? Not, and I don't mean this to be in a, I don't mean this in a negative way, but I can't help but think of just as an actor, are you really frustrated that you didn't get to be on 11 seasons of a TV show? You were so close, and now you're
Yeah.
back, and it's kind of like, oh, great, everyone here is friggin' loaded. Because they've been continually employed for 8 years. It's just got to be so strange. Such a weird experience.
Yeah, and his role in this is pretty small. So he didn't even, you know, I could see maybe coming back to do like a, you know, like a guest spot that sort of goes throughout the whole show. But maybe that would be too weird too, because fans would know that it's the same guy. And it's almost like an Easter egg that he's got, maybe a cameo, I'd say, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how he, I guess it depends on how he felt about leaving. You know, maybe he thought he had better options, and maybe he did. You know, maybe he's a stage actor. Sometimes stage actors, you know, will take long hiatuses from their TV career just to do theater again, and then come back later and, you know, have a good time and make some money.
Yeah, again, and I don't mean to be negative about John Orchard. Maybe he lived a wonderfully fulfilling life and he had no regrets. But I know that actors, a lot of them are just like, they're obsessed with their next job. Because of course, I was a freelance, I wasn't an actor, but I was self-employed for a decade, and it was an incredibly stressful way to live because you were
Oh
just
yeah.
constantly beating the bushes for work.
Right.
And it's just got to be weird to know you were on the first six episodes of this show and they let you go through no fault of your own. It was because they realized they just didn't want five or six, gang of the gang. They wanted to
Right.
thin it out
Yeah.
to just Hawkeye, Trapper, and kind of Radar.
Yeah.
But it's got to be brutal, right? To just to, and then to come back and the show is like a mega hit. It's
Yeah.
a, you know, you just, who wouldn't want that? You know, it just feels weird. It's like, of all the actors, you hire one that you fired from 7 years ago. It's just like weird, but okay, whatever. He did it. So, okay.
Yeah.
So, him and Winchester have this conversation, and they are talking at cross purposes because Muldoon is talking in code. Winchester doesn't know anything about the code. Rosie has not told Winchester about Muldoon. She's told Margaret, but Margaret obviously didn't tell Winchester. So Muldoon is expecting free liquor in his coffee cup and said he gets coffee. And Winchester is like, oh, of course. How did I know you? Why would I think you wanted coffee when you ordered coffee? And I love that he just chucks it.
Yeah.
He just throws it, you know, like on the bar or something. And then he puts cognac in there, and Muldoon says, I don't pay. And Winchester's like, then you don't drink. And he gets into the second fight in the last 3 minutes of the show. And Muldoon walks off, and we realize that obviously this is going to become quite a problem for Rosie in a little bit. So then we're back in Potter's office, and he is talking to the Pentagon. Klinger's very nervous, and they're following the sort of trail of the letter of where it's going. I like the whole bit about when he calls a general and he thinks the general is like the flunky. And he's like, oh, it's you, general. I like a man who answers his own phone.
Right.
Kind of Potter's old school values, right, in the 1950s. So we're sort of following them as they're following the trail of the letter. And we don't know where that's going to lead. And then we're back to Rosie's. And of course, as we just talked about, time is clearly passed because Rosie is now back on the bar. She's all healed up. So this is at least a couple of days. And obviously it's after the scene because Potter's there and Klinger's there. And she thanks them all for running the bar. And then she asks them who's going to pay the tab. And Margaret's like, your gratitude is overwhelming. Which is I love the way she shakes her head. I love she's going, okay, So then Potter says, well, we're not just here to celebrate Rosie being behind the bar, getting back behind the bar. And he announces that, he lets Pierce, he says, Pierce, the floor is yours. And Hawkeye announces that, in fact, there's a new captain's list and Mulcahy is on it. And he is now a captain. And they all stand. It's funny. They all stand. And they all give Mulcahy a salute, even Winchester, except Margaret. Margaret does not. You would think Margaret would be the person to do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I believe it about, you know, I think it's Winchester does it mistakenly. I mean, like, I don't think the actor made a mistake, but I think, you know, Winchester maybe doesn't know the whatever the traditions or regulations as well as Margaret does. Although, well, Potter does it too, doesn't he?
Yeah, Potter does. So, they're just being nice. It's not right. You're not supposed to salute an inferior officer when your majors don't salute captains. Blah, blah, doesn't go down the line. It goes up the line. Right. But they're just doing it to be nice. It's like Margaret.
Come on, Margaret.
Come on, Margaret. What the hell? She does a toast. She like lifts her good. But I just thought it was funny of all, like, the most stickler for rules. Well, maybe that's the reason why she's not doing it, is because it's not the way you're supposed to do it. I don't know. But again, if Potter does it, do it. Come on. What are you doing? Anyway, of course, Mulcahy is incredibly happy about that. And that's our act break. So then we come back and they've all been drinking and Mulcahy is regaling them in with bad jokes from this joke book that he had. And then Muldoon comes back and he says, I'm here to shut down the bar. And, Rosie's like, you know, what the hell? You know, like, you're not supposed to be doing that. And he's like, well, you should have thought about that before you put Chauncey Upper Crust behind the bar, which I just love that as a name, Chauncey Upper Crust. And I love that Rosie immediately goes, I'll get you for this, Chauncey. I love that she immediately goes.
And I got to say, it was a weird reaction for me to have, but for some reason, I had no idea that John Orchard was that tall. Because he's always crouched. He was, you know, Ugly John was always crouching by the anesthetic, you know.
Right.
And so he was always crouching down. And here he's like standing next to Charles and next to Hawkeye. And he's, you know, almost as tall as they are. And I'm like, wow, that dude's taller than I thought.
He's also got the giant hat, too. Big thing that he's got on. So anyway, and then so they start shutting down the bar and Mulcahy, a newly christened captain, thinks he can step in and he starts telling this horrible joke to Muldoon and they all stop him. And that's the end of our episode. That's Captain's Outrageous. So it's a nice, fun, warm-hearted episode. It's not any serious stuff. You know, the couple other ones this season have been very serious. Kind of like it's a sort of lighthearted. And as you say, we get to learn more about one of our tertiary characters. And I don't mean
Fantastic.
that that Nurse Kelly smokes.
That's right.
So it's a
Nurse
good one.
Kelly.
And I love that Mulcahy is a captain now. I just think that's great. And we
Yeah,
Klinger will
yeah.
get promoted later on, which is again, I think that's great. I like that they had the, you know, the evolution of the characters a little bit, that they
Yeah.
moved up through the ranks. Well, no one else wants to be promoted. Hawkeye and BJ are never going to get promoted.
No.
Margaret wants to get promoted. Winchester doesn't give a shit one way or the other. So
Yeah.
that's Captain's Outrageous. Now, before we get to favorite lines, I know, Stan, that you did like a little bit of research regarding the era that this episode aired in. It's not something we talk about, but I am fascinated by it. So why don't we get into that a little bit?
Yeah, so I do this on my podcast just because if it's especially if it's something that was broadcast during my lifetime, I kind of like to think back on not only where I was, but like what the world was like, what the world around me was like. And so, because a lot of times the context can inform, how a show is done, how it's written, stuff like that. So this came out December of 79. It was the third year of the Carter presidency, and one of the great things he did was helped broker a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. That's where 12-year-old me learned the names Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin.
Anwar Sadat. Yeah, that was the name, right?
This is also the year that the nuclear power plant at 3 Mile Island had a meltdown.
That's right.
If you've ever heard of that, also, this is the year, strangely enough, the Iranian Revolution happens that installs the Ayatollah Khomeini, but that leads to the Iran hostage crisis, which affects the presidential run the next year. NASA's Skylab falls to Earth. The IRA is active, the Irish Republican Army. They kill members of the royal family and 18 British soldiers with bombs. This is the year that the Who festival seating stampede kills 11 fans. It's also the year, on a lighter note, that the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was published. It is unfortunately the year that Jack Soo passed away.
From Barney Miller, yeah.
And this was the year that Disco Demolition Night happened at Comiskey Park in Chicago. And I don't know if that was national news, but in the Chicago area, it was a big deal.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, I
Yeah,
remember
yeah,
that.
yeah. They had to forfeit a game because it was a doubleheader. They did it between the games and destroyed the field. So it was unintentional.
America!
So very quickly in music, in the here's a couple of songs from the top 20: "Ladies' Night" by Kool and the Gang, "Take the Long Way Home" by Supertramp, "Heartache Tonight" by the Eagles, "Do That to Me One More Time" by the Captain and Tennille, the "Pina Colada" song by Rupert Holmes,
Oh boy.
"Still" by the Commodores, and these are all, by the way, from the week of December 10th. So this is the week that this episode came out. The number one song in America was "Babe" by Styx. And also in December of 79, the top box office was Kramer versus Kramer, Roller Boogie, 1941, All That Jazz, The Jerk, and number one at the box office was Star Trek: The Motion Picture.
There's some good movies, and I saw a bunch of those in the theater. I saw Kramer versus Kramer. My dad. You know what? I'll tell a story about that, but you continue with other information that you have. I don't want to interrupt
Oh,
you.
it's just one more, the Nielsens. I won't give the whole top 20, but two of them, Trapper John MD, the first season, was number 20, and House Calls with Wayne Rogers,
With Wayne
also the first
Rodgers.
season, that was number 14. It beat Trapper John. And then the top five was Dallas, season three. Alice is number four. MASH was number three in the Nielsens for this season. And they were beaten by Three's Company at number two, and number one was 60 Minutes on CBS.
I watched all those shows. Well, I didn't watch
Did
60 Minutes as a child, but I
you?
watched the other I watched all those shows. And that, you know, and then this is an era when, you know, being number three on network television meant every episode
Oh.
was being watched by like 25 million people.
Yeah,
You know,
it was a big
nowadays
deal.
networks are like 2 million. Woo, it's a hit, you know?
Yeah.
And back then it was like, oh yeah, you're number four and you only had 19 million or whatever it was. Thank you for all that. I appreciate the context. That is, you
Sure.
know, it was, I never liked Sticks, I have to say. So yeah, Kramer versus Kramer. I will tell a very brief story. Some people that listen to my other shows, they've already heard me tell the story, so I'll tell it really fast. My dad used to take me and my sister, it doesn't matter. My dad used to take me and my sister to out every week, well, at least once a week, and we would go to movies. And so one week we were going to go see some animated thing, I guess for me, and it was sold out. It was a theater inside the Neshaminy Mall in Pennsylvania, and it was sold out. And we had planned, you know, that was the whole evening was around this movie, and we couldn't go. So the other movie playing was Kramer versus Kramer. Now, of course, an 8-year-old doesn't want to see a drama about divorce. But my sister wanted to see it and my dad wanted to see it. So they sort of were like, well, can we bribe Bob, as I was known back then, to go see it? And my dad said, if you go with us, if you kind of like are willing to sit and watch this movie, I'll go buy you some comic books. And of course, I was always willing to do anything if you bought me some comic books. So I
Right.
was an easy bribe in that way. So I said, sure. And so we go watch Kramer versus Kramer. Now, have you ever seen that movie?
Yes,
Okay.
yes.
It's a
Not as a
great
child,
movie.
but
It's a great
yeah.
movie. It's a
Oh, yeah.
classic, but it's R-rated because of its tone, its language, and a brief scene of full frontal nudity
Oh.
featuring actress Jo Beth Williams. And that was a scene that I saw at 8 years old, and I remembered my father looking kind of horrified. And I didn't know what I was looking at. You know, I was eight. I was like, okay, but there's a scene where the Dustin Hoffman has got his son and he's living kind of a bachelor life, and he brings home a woman and they have like a one night stand, and she wakes up in the middle of the night and doesn't have any clothes on, and I guess she doesn't know the son is there or whatever, and he's there and she sees him and you see everything. So I remember being 8 years old and my dad was like, all right, I think it was like, don't tell your mother about that or whatever. So but anyway, yeah, so that's Kramer versus Kramer, everybody. Well, thank you for all that context. I like that. I know that might be something that if you come back for later seasons, we'll have to incorporate into the show, because I do like having that sort of context. That's what I was saying about, I like the commercials. You know, back in the back when they were originally airing, I wouldn't want to see them, but now I'm kind of like, oh, what was going on, right, in the world in 1979? So, all right, well, thank you for that, Stan. I appreciate it. So, what's your favorite line or joke from this episode?
Oh, it was a tie between two. I've gone back and forth, but I'm sticking with this one. It's toward the end. Hawkeye says, "Father Mulcahy, we live in a world of tradition, and as everyone knows, the military is full of it." I love his delivery. I love the way it's written. That's a great MASH joke. I love it.
That's like a season one Hawkeye MASH joke
Yeah.
too, right?
Yeah.
In that kind of just sticking it, whatever. Yeah, that is going. My favorite actually is from Rosie, where she's horrified at the meager profits that Margaret and the others have managed to get while they're running the bar, and Margaret defends herself and she goes, "Rosie, we're doing our best." And she responds, "How you people got to be a world power beats me." I love that joke so much. I love Rosie's view of geopolitics. I think it's just fantastic. How you people got to be a world power beats me. And you know, Rosie, same. You know,
Same,
so
same. Can I give my second place
sure.
line, because it's so I love it. I'll just say it. Why am I suddenly talking like some guy named Milton who's lost in Barcelona?
Oh, the Hawkeye line, right? When he's talking
When
to the
Hawk has,
waitress.
yeah, it's just so bizarre. Like it's just such a weird thing to say, and I love it.
And
Barcelona.
he's saying it to himself because he knows she doesn't understand it, so he's just kind of doing it to entertain himself. So yeah, this is a fun episode. They need to have some light ones once in a while,
Yeah.
and this is a fun. It's a nice one. So, well, Stan, thank you so much for coming on again. Thank you for being such a regular commenter for so long and a supporter of the show. I really appreciate it. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Absolutely. I do a classic TV podcast about the Wonder Woman show with Linda Carter, and I interview a Wonder Woman cosplayer for each episode, for the most part. Sometimes I have a guest that is not a cosplayer, but that's the idea, is to mostly have cosplayers. You can find those episodes and the socials related to them at WonderWomanWednesdays.com.
Very cool. All right. I love that. I watch that show too, right? I
Awesome.
love that show.
Oh, it's
So,
terrific.
yeah. So, anyway, thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate it for coming on. And
Thank
thank
you.
you, of course. And thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of MASHCAST on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. You can find me over on Blue Sky at Rob Kelly Creative. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, of which MASHCAST is a part, please go to patreon.com/FW podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Dennis Bailey, Daryl Clark, James K, Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P, Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Prom, Adam Sanders, Stefan Van Schaik, Britt Schramm, Billy Schulman, and Mike Thomas. I really do appreciate it. So thank you all for listening. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
Stinking college boy!
Graduated summa cum laude, lettered in crew and polo, women dripping off me. Rah, rah, rah.